The Guardian.
Boris Johnson celebrates a year in office with the gift of a damning Russia report. I'm Jonathan Friedland, columnist at The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly.
The outrage isn't that there was interference. The outrage is that no one has wanted to know if there was interference.
The long-awaited report into Russian interference in the Brexit referendum showed that neither the British government nor intelligence agencies looked in any meaningful way into Kremlin attempts to interfere with the 2016 vote on British membership of the EU. The 50-page document published on Tuesday from Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee showed how ministers turned a blind eye to allegations of Russian disruption and treated it as the hot potato of politics, meaning they actively avoided doing anything about it. Despite the findings, the government quickly shut down any suggestion that a new review was now needed to look into Russian interference in the Brexit referendum. But the security services will be given extra powers to try to prevent foreign interference in British democracy in future. So, which Conservative government do we blame for this lack of oversight? Is this on Boris Johnson or Theresa May or David Cameron? And what will be its impact? Will it force the current government to do anything different? And while the UK dealt or didn't deal with Russia, EU leaders spent 5 days at the negotiating table, eventually agreeing on how to spend a whopping €750 billion coronavirus recovery fund package. Jennifer Rankin gives us the latest from Brussels later on in the podcast. Plus, as the Green Party of England and Wales prepares for next month's leadership election, Peter Walker talks to the two candidates hoping to beat the incumbent favourites. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, a lot has happened in Westminster this week, but I thought I'd start off by looking specifically at what that Russian report showed us and why it was so damning. And to help me do that, no one better than Luke Harding, the former Moscow correspondent for The Guardian, who's written a string of best-selling books on Putin's Russia, including his new book Shadow State, which looks at the Russia report and how Downing Street turned a blind eye. Luke, Boris Johnson hinted a while back that when we did eventually get to see this report into Russian interference in the EU referendum, that we'd be bored. That was his idea, that there was really nothing there of note. So how about it? Were you bored on Tuesday when you finally got to read it?
Jonathan, if I'm honest, I have to say I did a little victory dance around the empty Guardian newsroom, because as you say, Downing Street aides had been saying it's a big yawn, that we're all conspiracy theorists, that there's nothing to see here. And actually, the report was sober, it was credible, and it was overwhelmingly damning. Essentially, it said that the government hadn't bothered to find out whether the Russians had meddled in the Brexit vote of 2016. And so I think it's pretty devastating, and I think it demands a serious response from government. Whether we get it is another matter.
Wouldn't it have been even more damning if it had actually laid out the evidence that showed, yes, the Russians did actually interfere with the vote?
Well, I mean, it would have been, but this is the kind of great frustration. And we don't know if it was deliberate that the government didn't investigate Russian influence over Brexit, or whether it was just oversight. The hard pro-Brexit faction, the Vote Leave faction that are now encamped in Downing Street, were the beneficiaries of this Russian operation. And the reason they're behaving in such an ostrich-like way is they don't want anything to raise questions about the legitimacy of the EU referendum vote. And they want to sweep it all under the carpet.
So they didn't look, and we don't know, because they didn't want to know.
They didn't want to know. And even if we were to investigate and then conclude that this was around the edges, that would be okay. But I think the scandal is the government does not want to look at this, just wants us all to move on really what was the most consequential vote for Britain of the 21st century.
Just on a process question, it has taken a year since the review was completed to have this finally see the light of day. The Intelligence and Security Committee in Parliament, who drew it up, have been very quick to reject the Prime Minister's explanation for that delay. Are we right to think we actually could have seen this report before last December's election without any problem?
Well, we could have done it. It had been cleared and vetted by the security agencies, and practically all of the evidence which was given to it by a series of expert witnesses was submitted in 2018. So it was ready to roll. It was oven ready, to use a Boris Johnson phrase. But now we've seen it. We know why he didn't want it out. First of all, it's embarrassing. It shows that he is Foreign Secretary and Theresa May is Prime Minister were reluctant to interrogate the Russia Brexit question. And also, I think back then, when he'd effectively lost his parliamentary majority, I think he must have been afraid that there would have been a vote to force a kind of internal Whitehall and spy agency inquiry into all of this. Now he's won his majority with people voting and being none the wiser. He's got out of that problem.
And we had in Prime Minister's questions just now, as you and I speak, the Prime Minister effectively dissing those people asking questions about it, saying,
"There's been no doubt what this is really all about, Mr. Speaker. This is about pressure from the Islingtonian Remainers who have seized on this report to try to give the impression that the Russian interference was somehow responsible for Brexit, Mr. Speaker."
Yeah, I thought that was quite insulting. And wherever you stand on the Brexit argument, that there's a clear interest in knowing that our political processes are not being subverted by hostile foreign actors. And it may be Russia today or China tomorrow or North Korea or whoever. It's about the integrity of our voting systems and knowing as citizens that our votes actually count for something. And Putin is not a supervillain who causes everything, but he's a classic KGB opportunist and adventurist. And he loves Brexit because it weakens the European Union, his great foe, and it diminishes the UK, another adversary since Cold War times. So we have this uncomfortable thing where Russian foreign policy and Johnsonian foreign policy are perfectly aligned.
The Intelligence and Security Committee referred to this issue of Russian interference as a hot potato for successive governments. Where do you think we should be putting the blame? Who comes out of this looking bad? It's odd, isn't it? Because the referendum was under David Cameron, the immediate aftermath was under Theresa May, and Boris Johnson is in number 10 now. So who should we be blaming for this?
Well, I think they're all co-guilty. I think May shoulders a lot of responsibility. I mean, she clearly saw it as a kind of almost quasi-religious duty to implement the will of the people around Brexit. And she just didn't want to investigate what Russia had done. And what the IC said very clearly is that there were flashing lights. We saw Russian activity around the Scottish referendum vote in 2014. GCHQ, the listening agency, knew in spring 2016 that Russian spies had seized Democratic Party emails in America to try and undermine Hillary Clinton. So there was plenty of warning, and yet nothing was done to protect the referendum or to investigate what happened afterwards, like we saw with Robert Mueller in the United States. And just lastly, the spy agencies, it was pretty humiliating for them. MI5 was asked by the committee what happened with Brexit, and they produced a 6-line reply. You get the impression that the James Bonds of this world were terrified of offending power, of offending government. Really, their job, their counterintelligence function, is to fight back against Russian threats. But over Brexit, they were effectively on tea break.
Just a quote from the report. It says that Russian influence in the UK is the new normal. If that's right, are you confident, Luke, that the government is actually in a position to deal with Russian interference, not in the past, in the Brexit vote of 2016, but now and in the future?
Well, actually, Russian interference is the old normal, to be honest. What Vladimir Putin has done very cleverly is take the Soviet playbook of trying to destabilize enemy countries and exploit their divisions and weaknesses. And he's updated it for our shiny age of Facebook and Twitter, and more successfully than KGB generals did. He has enormous reach. And we have to remember that Putin is now going to be in power until potentially 2036. He's just won a constitutional referendum. And so thus far, I haven't seen anything convincing which suggests that Boris Johnson has the will or the conceptual ability to fight back against it. So you and I will be talking about this in future, and I think our democracy is in a pretty precarious and vulnerable position still.
Luke Harding, thank you very much for joining us in a busy, busy week for you. I want to turn to The Guardian's political correspondent, Kate Proctor, now, because on top of this important report, there's been lots going on in Westminster. Kate, just before we let go of the Russia story, we are recording this just after the last Prime Minister's question time before the summer break. And Keir Starmer was very, very strong in his condemnation on this issue.
The government's taken its eye off the ball. Arguably, it wasn't even on the pitch. After this government's been in power for 10 years, how does the Prime Minister explain that?
But the Prime Minister was not having any of it.
Mr. Speaker, I think the right honourable gentleman's questions are absolutely absurd. There is no country in the Western world that is more vigilant.
So, Kate, quite testy exchanges between the Leader of the Opposition and the Prime Minister on this Russia report.
It was. It was a real fiery one for the last PMQs. There was a real end of term feel about it, and it was about sort of trading those final blows over the Russia report that they're able to get in before recess. And you know, Keir Starmer, he was pretty sustained in his argument. He was saying constantly that the Prime Minister has allowed many, many months to go by without any action on this because this report was delayed from November 2019. And he kept on asking the Prime Minister, what's the reason for that? Why is that? And I don't think Boris Johnson particularly was able to give a strong answer on that. But he did very ferociously come back at Keir Starmer and say, well, actually, under Labour, under the leadership of Jeremy Corbyn, that Labour was parroting lines from the Kremlin. And he was making reference to this close relationship that Jeremy Corbyn may not have had with the Russians. So they definitely traded blows on some really big issues.
I mean, it's an open question whether it works, actually, trying to blame Keir Starmer for the record of Jeremy Corbyn. Some Labour people, I think, might welcome the contrast there, because obviously it's under new management now. What do you know about this response from Keir Starmer, referring to Boris Johnson's vacillation on the big Brexit question, writing a piece in favour and a piece against? People have been wondering whether Keir Starmer's got it in him to think on his feet. What did you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that probably is quite a fair criticism. He's not so nimble at the comebacks, but he did actually come back with a joke today, which really, really did go down very well. So Boris Johnson always accuses him of flip-flopping. And Keir Starmer came back and said, look, well, you know, I'm hearing this from a man who's written two versions of every single article he's ever written, which entirely goes to the heart of Boris Johnson's previous thoughts on the European Union and then his pivot to being a very strong Brexiter. So actually Starmer was able to come back, and there was quite a lot of laughter in the House of Commons at that point.
So those exchanges marking the end of this session before people go off for the recess. But it's been a rather full week for British politics, even outside the chamber, with the visit of the United States Secretary of State Mike Pompeo coming here and for meetings with the Foreign Secretary and with the Prime Minister. It all looked very chummy between Mike Pompeo, Boris Johnson, Dominic Raab, didn't it?
Oh, it really did. It was as if the US was giving the UK a really big pat on the head. Pompeo was saying, you know, he praised the UK for the Huawei ban, praised them again for opening the doors to Hong Kongers, for the generous spirit of the British people. And he actually just said, you know, we think well done, which was a really quite bizarre statement to hear. It's not really the kind of purely diplomatic language that you're maybe used to hearing on these visits, but I mean, in terms of pleasing America, it does appear that the UK has recently done a very good job on its position on China.
And before we let you go, Kate, some big news from the Labour Party earlier today. Just like we had to wait a long time for that report, this was a statement that people had been waiting for in the form of an apology.
Yeah, this is going to cause real ructions within Labour. So we've had the High Court case, which was all about the Panorama programme, and it was about the whistleblowers who felt that they had been smeared by the Labour Party in a press statement that they released after the Panorama programme. So they settled the case, and Labour has apologised for that press release that was released under the leadership of Jeremy Corbyn. They say, we unreservedly withdraw all allegations of bad faith, malice and lying on behalf of the whistleblowers, and they've also agreed to pay damages. And I thought it was interesting that Keir Starmer issued this statement and issued this apology saying that under the leadership of Keir Starmer and Angela Rayner, she's the deputy leader of the Labour Party, that they're committed to tackling anti-Semitism. I just thought it was interesting that he referenced Angela Rayner too, because you could say that she was someone who was much closer to Jeremy Corbyn than Keir Starmer ever was. And to use her and to have her at the heart of this apology and the heart of this payout is quite interesting politicking from Starmer, because you know, he's trying to show that the entire party leadership is moving away and trying to draw a line under all these accusations of anti-Semitism that have been going around for such a long time, and also showing a break from in the leadership team from some of the people that were close to Jeremy Corbyn.
Very interesting. I agree, as if he wanted some sort of political cover by bringing Angela Rayner's name into it. There's two more relevant reports to come. The big one is the Equalities and Human Rights Commission report. That inquiry, we're hearing now, may not come till September. And there is this other inquiry, the so-called Ford inquiry, set up by the Labour Party leader to investigate the leaking of a long internal report, again into this same question of anti-Semitism in the party, and that too taking some time. What's your read of how this is working for him? Is he succeeding, Keir Starmer, in drawing a line under the anti-Semitism question, which obviously did cause such problems for the Labour Party under its previous management?
I don't think it draws a line under this issue in terms of party membership at all. We've seen people, you know, that were very close to Jeremy Corbyn, Matt Zarb's cousin. He was at one point his spokesperson. He was tweeting today that this is absolute Orwellian nonsense, everything that's going on within the party at the moment around anti-Semitism and the response. I'd imagine he thinks he's put an end to it for now. But of course, the Equalities and Human Rights report that is due out later in September into the Labour Party and anti-Semitism is obviously going to open all of this again, depending on what that report comes back with. So I think it's a temporary pause, and it's a small line that's been drawn under this, but something that's going to have to be revisited.
Kate Proctor, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much.
We still have a lot of news to cover. After the break, Jennifer Rankin reports on an historic EU spending agreement, and we hear from leadership candidates for the Green Party of England and Wales. We'll be back after this.
Hello?
If I asked you to tell me a story about you,
hello,
what would you say?
He's got this like really weird thing in his head where he thinks I'm like a witch.
I'm Leia Green, and this is Innermost, a new podcast from The Guardian about strangers and their secret lives.
The curtain goes round the coffin. That feels very strange.
Listen now on Acast or wherever you get your podcasts.
Innermost is supported by Vodafone.
Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Jonathan Friedland. Now, while the UK waited to hear what the report into Russian interference would say, EU leaders had a few sleepless nights this past weekend as they tried to come up with an agreement on a €750 billion coronavirus pandemic recovery fund. As The Guardian's Brussels correspondent Jennifer Rankin now explains, there were some sizeable bumps along the way.
We have a lot of work ahead of us, but tonight is a big step forward towards recovery.
So EU leaders have been meeting in Brussels, and at the end of a very long summit have finally agreed on a €1.8 trillion package. And that includes a €750 billion coronavirus recovery package, but also the EU's long-term budget, the budget for the 7 years starting from 2021. So there was an enormous amount of money on the table, and to no great surprise, it was never going to be easy to agree those kind of sums, especially given the tensions between different EU member states. The most obvious one was between four Northern European member states and the rest. Those four, known as the Frugal Four, even calling themselves the Frugal Four, are the Netherlands, Austria, Sweden, Denmark. They've taken a very tough line throughout. They came into this negotiation saying they couldn't possibly sign up to grants for the hardest hit economies. They wanted the whole recovery plan to be funded through loans, which would eventually be paid back. So they made a big concession in the end by ultimately agreeing to 390 billion euros worth of grants. But if they think economic reforms in different member states are not going far enough, which has been a long-term complaint of these countries, then they can raise the issue at another EU summit and potentially slow down the release of any recovery funds, although not stop it. It's not the veto that the Dutch Prime Minister had originally sought.
Red box, the Dutch. Blue corner, Hungary.
And the other conflict is between Western European member states and two Central European countries, Hungary and Poland in particular.
I don't know what is the personal reason for the Dutch Prime Minister to hate me or Hungary, but he is attacking so harshly.
And it's important to know that Hungary and Poland are currently subject to an EU process investigating the rule of law in both those countries, because it's widely seen that these governments are undermining the independence of the judiciary, and there are many wider concerns about how they treat minorities. So Western European states came into these negotiations saying that no country should be able to benefit from EU funds unless it's fully signed up to European democratic values. So these countries were ultimately successful in fighting off any link to EU funds and the rule of law. And EU leaders said they would come back to this question another day. And as a result of these underlying tensions, we saw some really heated moments in the summit. Emmanuel Macron, the French president, actually banged his fist on the table because he was so frustrated with the approach taken by the so-called frugal countries. We also saw those so-called frugal four being called the misers by the Polish prime minister. We saw Viktor Orban in quite an extraordinary way accusing the Dutch prime minister of, or comparing him to the communist era police. So we saw some really extraordinary levels of acrimony and vitriol, which makes this summit, I think, one that will really sort of last in the memory as something particularly bitter and particularly difficult. And although there was ultimately an agreement, I think the legacy of this summit will sort of remain in people's minds and will continue to influence how different EU countries relate to each other. So a turning point came early on Monday when the 27 leaders decided they were going to stay in Brussels for their second unscheduled day, because remember, this summit was supposed to end on Saturday evening. And finally, in the early hours of Tuesday morning, the 27 reached a deal, which was announced by the European Council President, Charles Michel, with a one-word tweet: deal.
And most importantly, this is the right deal for Europe right now. This agreement will be seen as a pivotal moment in Europe's journey.
And then very rapidly, the EU leaders gave their press conferences, where they gave somewhat different accounts of what had been agreed.
Conclusions sont véritablement historiques.
Macron, for example, describing this as a historic deal for the EU. But on the other hand, you had Rutte, the Dutch Prime Minister, simply saying, well, these were exceptional circumstances and the recovery plan we have agreed is a one-off. So avoiding some of the grander language we saw from the French president. I think EU leaders will leave this summit with, first of all, a sense of relief that there is an agreement, because there was a sense that if they failed to reach a deal this time, they would be back here in a few days, maybe in a month's time, and they would have to do it all over again when all the arguments would remain the same and all the sticking points would remain the same. And also, there would have been, I think, a sense of the EU being tarnished if it had been shown unable to take a decision during such a big crisis.
Der Europäischen Union für die nächsten 7 Jahre gestellt und gleichzeitig eine.
So we heard from Angela Merkel on Tuesday morning, who said that it was a very important message to the rest of Europe, but also to the rest of the world, that shows that the EU can act together when it wants to.
The Guardian's Jennifer Rankin. Now, August is normally a quiet month in UK politics, but it's a big month for the Green Party of England and Wales. Next month, they will hold an election to choose their next leader or leaders. The incumbents, Sean Berry and Jonathan Bartley, are favourites to win a second term, but two other candidates have entered the fray. Rosie Sexton is a relative newcomer to the political world, having only been elected as a councillor for Solihull last year. Shara Ali is a more seasoned Green Party member, having served as deputy leader back in 2014. They each have very different views as to which direction their party should take. My colleague, The Guardian's political correspondent Peter Walker, spoke to both of them earlier this week.
So let's start with a brief background about who you are and what you've kind of done to get, you know, where you are now. Rosie, I'll turn to you first. So what's your pre-politics background?
I've had an interesting and varied background. I started off by studying maths at university. I did a PhD in computer science. And then in a completely normal and logical career progression, I went off and became a professional mixed martial artist for 12 years.
I think I read about this. You were the first woman to take part in the UFC. The first British woman.
That's right. I was the first British woman to compete in the UFC back in 2013.
Which, for people who don't know that, what does that stand for? Ultimate Fighting Championships? That's the kind of Premier League of that kind of thing, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. So after that, I retired from active competition in 2014. By then, I'd qualified as an osteopath, and I now run my own clinic. So that's the day job alongside the politics that I do.
So after all of that, what prompted you to get into the leadership battle?
The real driving factor here is that I see the Green Party as being at a transition point in its journey. We're at a fork in the road, and we really have to decide where we're going. Because at the moment, we're the fourth party of English politics. We have quite a lot of influence, and a lot of our policies end up being badly recycled by the other parties. I want us to go further than that. I want us to become a mainstream major political force. As I see it, to do that, we need to change some things about what we're doing. So I'd really like to start having that conversation within the party about how we're going to do that, how we're going to develop into that mainstream political force and take political power on our own terms.
Shara, you've been a figure in the Greens slightly longer. You were a former deputy leader and you stood for the leadership election in 2018. But let people know a bit more about what your background is and, you know, again, how you got to where you are now.
Well, I started life educationally, vocationally as a biochemical engineer. So I worked a little bit in the field. Then I did degrees in philosophy, ended up with a PhD in philosophy. I've actually been in the party 18 years. I kind of feel as if I cannot but be political. It's in my bloodstream, really. The climate emergency is just such a horrendous catastrophe waiting to happen. We're sleepwalking into it. I'm a founder signatory of Extinction Rebellion, which I think is an important plank of how we do politics as well in terms of our campaigning aims. And many Greens actually, you know, we have to hold down day jobs. I'm no different. I work in medical education at the minute, so I've been working in that area as well.
Shara, if I can ask you, I mean, the Greens seem to be doing reasonably well. They did quite well at the local and European elections. And also the 2019 election result was kind of an improvement on the 2017 one. I mean, where do you think potentially the leadership is, I guess, doing things wrong if you want to do things like better?
Well, you know, it's easy to criticise, isn't it? And I think they've been doing a sterling job on top of all the other things they're doing also as Green politicians, you know, whether councillor, London Assembly member. But really, the 2019 result, which you've mentioned, was disastrous for us. We shouldn't have got involved in the Unite to Remain alliance and pact, Lib Dem pacts. I think, you know, they're a toxic party to get involved. If anybody understands our core Green votes and message will know that that was a compromise too far. What the public is crying out for is for politicians and politics to speak truth. They want to hear the alarming truth on climate change. And I really do believe that we need to, in order to punch above our weight, as we do often in councils and across the country when we do get elected, we've really got to be bold, unapologetic about our green vision. We've understandably, as a Green Party as well, spent a lot of our time and energy campaigning, whether on Brexit negotiations over the last 2 years or trying to have another referendum, or even now during COVID lockdown. I think we have to live in a sustainable manner. We cannot go on in this way. Politically, those messages are not being made boldly, clearly, for the systemic change that we need. And I want to be doing that if elected as leader.
I think I see things a little bit differently from Shara. So in terms of the 2019 election results, I think there were certainly some things that we could have done differently in hindsight. I would stop short of saying it was disastrous. I think there are a lot of other things going on that factored into the results there. I think the important thing now is to focus on what we do in the future. The problem is not that people don't understand that there's an issue with the climate emergency. This is actually really well known. And as I say, there's groups like XR who do some great work raising that awareness. I think the challenge we face actually is getting a mandate for action. That's a lot more challenging than just going out and shouting about things, because we know psychologically, sometimes the harder you push, the more people will push back against that. So actually we need to go out and we need to meet people where they are and bring them with us and take them on that journey. So the way I see it was we need to tackle some of those stereotypes that people have of the Green Party at the moment, because I talk to a lot of people who still think that we're a single issue party, that we're for white middle class vegans. We need to be a lot more inclusive. We need to go out and we need to speak to people and communities who may not be stereotypical Green voters, who may not think of themselves as Greens. And we also need to focus on electoral success. So we need to get over that idea that a Green vote is a wasted vote because we can't win.
If I could return, Shara, to this idea of some people seeing a Green vote as being a wasted vote. If you're not keen on the Greens, for example, collaborating in electoral pacts with people like the Lib Dems, I mean, how do you get over that? Because the Greens have still only got one member of parliament, and unless the electoral system changes, it's going to be quite difficult to get any more. I mean, do you think you should be focusing on getting more MPs in the Commons, or do you think maybe the Greens' influence is more at a kind of local or citywide level, for example, you know, with the London mayoral elections or councils or, you know, that kind of thing? Where would your focus be?
What I would say around this is that, you know, we've had a referendum on a kind of an offer on proportional representation, which failed. I don't think there's a massive appetite for this, although we will campaign on it. The number one priority for me and for this party must be the climate emergency. You know, we need to be vocalizing that urgency. We need to be talking about changing the economy. We've got a linear economy. You know, we need to move that to a circular economy. That is to say, it's got to be sustainable. Bottom line, let's get back to the facts. People may know them, but they need to be constantly reminded of the catastrophe to future generations and non-human animals. Greens are not just about looking after one. We're also about looking after our contemporaries halfway around the world who are having to suffer the consequences of our overconsumption. This is not a fire drill. This is an emergency. And the Greens need to be vocalizing that action. That's exactly what is required today, not tomorrow.
I disagree with Shara on this point, because I agree with him entirely on the urgency of tackling the climate emergency. However, I disagree with him about the strategy for doing that, because we know that people will not vote for us, or there will be a lot of people who won't vote for us while they see us as a single issue party. They want politicians who will tackle not only the climate emergency, but all of the issues they face in their day-to-day lives. So for somebody who is living in poverty or is facing issues of discrimination, is wondering how they're going to put food on the table next week, the climate emergency can seem an awful long way off, even though we know it isn't. In order to get votes from those people, we need to be tackling their everyday issues, and we need to be speaking about those just as passionately as we are about the climate emergency and our environmental campaigning. And that's how we will gain the credibility and the trust in order to get the change that we need.
Shara, if I could go back to you, in terms of practical changes, I mean, one of the kind of almost an opportunity for green ideas that coronavirus has kind of brought up is that the way that cities are transporting people around has changed an awful lot. You know, in some ways, this is a bad thing, because public transport, which obviously is normally a very kind of green thing, it's very, very difficult for big city public transport to carry nearly as many people as it normally would. So a lot of cities are trying to introduce measures for kind of cycling and walking and things like that, rather than just returning to mass use of cars. I mean, what do you think the Greens can offer in kind of terms of this? And do you see it as a chance for cities to maybe change?
Absolutely. The fact is that social justice is inextricably linked to the climate emergency. And so we've always been about joining the dots, looking at how we can reduce our energy consumption in transport, in housing and retrofitting, and in transport in particular. You can see, again, this government's completely backward priorities. And we've got an HS2 scheme, 100 billion and counting. We would be putting that 100 billion, by the way, into retrofitting housing. 100 billion a year for the next 10 years is 1 trillion. That's the kind of scale of change that we need. And we've seen in COVID, the real need is local. We need to be redirecting that money even, not into road building schemes, but into local regional buses, because people are desperate to want to be able to live sustainably, reduce their carbon footprint. They're not able to do that at the minute. They're forced to use the car because of such bad, unaffordable, unreliable transportation. And again, the Green New Deal, it's a revolution in how we consume. It's a revolution in what energy production we have at our disposal. We should be world leading in that, and yet we're not. So yes, social justice, bread and butter issues, and the climate emergency are all inextricably bound together in the Green Party, and it should be made our number one priority.
Rosie, if I could turn back to you. Looking from the outside, it can sometimes seem like the kind of fate of the England and Wales Green Party is to come up with ideas which were initially laughed at and then kind of thought about and then, you know, taken on board by Labour like 4 or 5 years later. And it does seem like if the economy is going to be reshaped and if, you know, city centres are never going to be the same again, then the time could come for ideas like not only the universal basic income, but also even perhaps the 4-day week. Given the fact the Green Party is a relatively small party still, do you think part of your role is to basically get those ideas out there and then, you know, let them be kind of taken up?
I think this is part of how politics works. It's not just about being in charge and being in a position where you can implement those policies from the top down. It's about being in the room and making those arguments and winning those arguments and having those policies taken forward by whoever is in power. And I think this is where people can underestimate the influence that even a few Greens have. And by the way, we have three parliamentarians. We have one MP and two members of the House of Lords. So they're making those arguments and they're putting that case very powerfully. So we've been able to have an influence even while being in opposition. What we're saying to people is, just imagine how much more we could do with more councillors, more MPs. This is why we need people voting green. And as I say, in order to get those green votes, we need to present people with a comprehensive offer. And actually, we're capable, we're competent, we're informed, we can manage things.
The leadership election is taking place now, and by the end of August, we should know who the next leader or leaders of the Green Party of England and Wales are going to be. As the incumbents, and as I would probably say the better known or best known candidates, Sean Berry and Jonathan Partley are probably the favourites to win, but you two are obviously very much in the fight to win it. I mean, whether or not either of you win, in kind of, you know, 30 or 40 seconds, what do you think would be the number one priority you'd really, really want the leadership of the Greens to focus on in the next couple of years? Shara, maybe you go first.
It's the climate emergency. We are about completely changing the way that people look at politics. It's not just about the electoral machine. It is about social, ecological, environmental transformation. And at the end of the day, who are all those other beings with an interest in how we do politics? It's future generations, people who aren't around here to be able to press their claims upon us because they don't exist yet. They will not be left with an inhabitable planet in 10, 20, 100 or 200 years. We are living in a completely unsustainable way. It's all those beautiful species that we share the planet with in terms of biodiversity loss. We have got to be stronger in how we articulate the truth about the fact that we are not living within our means.
I think in order to take our influence to the next level, we now need to focus on being serious about inclusion, about speaking to people who are not stereotypical Green voters. We need to take political power on our own terms. We're more than just a pressure group. We need to get Greens into the corridors of power and at the table when those decisions are being made.
Rosie Sexton, Shara Ali, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Members of the Green Party will be able to vote from August the 3rd to the 31st, and it's expected that we'll know the results soon afterwards. And that is all from us this week. Make sure to listen out to tomorrow's episode of Today in Focus as The Guardian's Daniel Boffey explains why the COVID crisis has cemented fault lines in European Union solidarity. Just search for Today in Focus wherever you get your podcasts. But for me, a huge thanks to all of our guests, Luke Harding, Kate Proctor, Peter Walker, Jennifer Rankin, Rosie Sexton, and Shara Ali. The producer is Danielle Stevens. I'm Jonathan Friedland. Please take care of yourselves, and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.